This is the takeaway for Tuesday, March 7th, 2017.
This is our one chance. We don't want to look back in a dozen years and say, ooh, this healthcare thing's gotten out of hand.
Look, we campaigned on this. We assured the American people that if you put Republicans in charge, we would fix what is in a death spiral.
Now, I know that there are strong views about this. There should be strong views about this. Healthcare is very personal.
Can I give you a little secret? I don't even know what the GOP plan is.
Yeah, it is Obamacare gone.
Republicans like to tell this story about how the Affordable Care Act is unraveling. It's a fiction that they created.
We could just let Obamacare crash under its own weight.
We're seeing the Obamacare healthcare marketplace collapse.
It's been an unmitigated disaster.
The risk in eliminating the individual mandate is that insurers still have to provide coverage to people with pre-existing conditions, but may not get enough healthy people to balance that out.
As access to does not mean that they are guaranteed health care. I have access to buying a $10 million home. I don't have the money to do that.
Rather than getting that new iPhone that they just love and they want to go spend hundreds of dollars on that, maybe they should invest it in their own health care.
But it must be the plan they want, not the plan forced on them by our government.
The takeaway. I'm John Huckenberry in the pilot seat, trying to pilot us out of the death spiral. It's kind of a day for plan Bs or second tries or restarts or redos. Thanks so much for listening. And we especially appreciate it because we know your listening is voluntary. More about that in a moment. This hour, we have a very surprising exploration of gender issues in the military and how the women's movement in the African nation of Liberia has lessons for the confusing aftermath of the 2016 election right here in the USA. Also, the Trump administration's second try on its Muslim country travel ban relieves some Iraqis who are not a part of the ban all of a sudden. But still, it makes it hard to project an actual policy to the nations of the Muslim world. But first, is it true the brand new American Health Care Act, the AHCA, wants to take a page from public radio and get rid of the Obamacare compulsory mandate to sign up for health care? It's going to be voluntary from now on. By Easter and Passover, the Republican leadership and the Trump administration hope to pass this AHCA and make good on their promise to replace the Affordable Care Act with a voluntary system. There are more details to the system, and we'll be talking with Todd Zwillick about that in just a moment. But will it get the uninsured to sign up voluntarily? Obamacare signed up well over 10 million people, according to conservative estimates. Will voluntary incentives outdo that number? Can they? There are also no cost or coverage estimates for this plan, and there isn't 100% buy-in from the congressional Republicans, four key Republican senators, all from states that opted to expand their Medicaid program under the Affordable Care Act, the ACA, have said they will oppose any plan that still leaves millions uninsured. So, Todd Zwillick, Takeaway Washington correspondent, it's voluntary, but will it work?
That's the big question. Will it work politically for millions of people, John, who pay for their coverage, who have coverage and don't want to lose it? And will it work for the factionated Republican conferences in the House and the Senate, who, as you said, are going to take the next couple of weeks to try to meet the very ambitious goal of getting a replacement passed by Easter Passover, the middle of April? That seems awfully ambitious considering the number of senators who are gazing over to the House today and saying, I don't know about this plan that they're hatching over there, especially because I don't know how much it's going to cost. You haven't told us how many people it's going to cover, and you haven't told us what's going to happen with Medicaid. All questions are going to have to be answered here, and we can talk about those details.
Is this a Trump plan? Is it a Ryan plan? Is it a compromise plan from within the Republican caucus of the House?
This is a Paul Ryan plan that has run into the political realities of 7 years of a country on increasingly popular Obamacare. Paul Ryan has had designs on the healthcare system for his entire career. So has Tom Price, the HHS secretary. We all know that. And now you're in this situation where millions of Americans have realized some benefits either on the individual insurance markets under the ACA or through expanded Medicaid, John, in 31 states. Now, we all know that Republicans have had as the top plank in their platform for the entire Barack Obama presidency doing away with Obamacare, right? They had those, whatever, 40 or 50 repeal votes. Well, that's fine, taking, you know, taking shots at the punch clown. This is different now. This is Paul Ryan's aspirations meeting a political reality. And that is partly why many conservatives in the House, maybe to Paul Ryan's right, have already started panning this plan as Obamacare 2.0, Obamacare Lite. The chairman of the Conservative Republican Study Committee has already called it a Republican welfare entitlement. So getting all the Republicans on the same page here. This is early days, by the way. There's just because some Republicans are panning this plan doesn't mean it can't pass, doesn't mean something can't pass. It means it's probably not going to pass in the form that we're talking about today. And we can talk about sort of what the political realities mean for that form and for consumers, too.
The key metric, and I hate to use that word because it's jargon, but the Obamacare plan signed up over 10 million people, and some Democrats will tell you it was like 22 million people who were signed up. Is that the target that Republicans with a voluntary system have to meet for this to be politically viable in 4 years?
Well, really, the political viability, it seems, is going to depend on individual voters, their individual pocketbooks, and their individual experience with their insurance company and with their doctor. Sure, there are lots of political talking points and top-line rhetoric that will get made if people lose coverage under the Republican plan. There was an aspiration when this got started, which was aided by President Trump's own rhetoric, which I can tell you drove congressional Republicans crazy, that everybody who's covered now will continue to have coverage. It will be better and cheaper. Nobody who's ever looked at healthcare policy thought that that was a reality or anything close to reality. There are trade-offs in healthcare policy, in particular, so many interconnected parts. It was fun for the president to say that, but nobody putting on the green visors, John, and getting down to the reality and the billions of healthcare coverage thought that that was ever realistic. So what is realistic? Replacing the individual mandate, as you said, the requirement that you buy insurance, that goes away, but they still need a way to encourage people, to get people to buy into the system, because if you don't, you're going to have an old system where only people who need insurance, who are sicker and older, are the ones who buy it. If you get that, you get very expensive coverage and a bunch of young, healthy people waiting out. So how do Republicans do that? They don't force you to buy coverage anymore, but if you have coverage that's dropped for more than 63 days, let's say you leave your job and you go to become self-employed, 63 days pass, the insurance companies can now charge you a 30% surcharge. They're trying to encourage you to keep your coverage, to not let it lapse. But this could have a perverse incentive. One thing it could do, it could have the opposite effect. You might be more willing to pay that 30% if you need coverage than if you don't. And then there's a system of tax credits. They're not called subsidies here, but there's a system of tax credits in the new plan, John, that basically shifts benefits, and I'm talking in generalities here, away from older and sicker people and toward younger and healthier people. If you're older and sicker, you're probably going to do less well under the Republican plan as it's currently designed. And if you're younger and healthier, you'll probably do a lot better under the tax credit system that's designed. And let me finally tell you about Medicaid. The Medicaid expansion, which covered more than 10 million people in 31 states that took it. The AHCA does away with the Medicaid expansion, but only after 2020. What they're telling these states is you can keep your expanded population and we'll keep paying for them through 2020. On January 1st, 2020, the expansion is over. It's frozen. No new people can come on under the expansion. And what we expect after that is for Medicaid populations to drop off over the years, and states then have to freeze their Medicaid enrollments and they get a block grant after that. So between now and 2020, you wouldn't see a lot of change if you were in a Medicaid expansion state, but after that, rolls would probably drop off significantly.
Let's hear some reaction from people who have weighed in on whether this is a good idea or what political battles are yet to be fought.
You're first going to hear from Greg Walden. He's chairman of the Energy and Commerce Committee, and he's from Oregon. His committee has part of the jurisdiction here, and they're going to start marking up this bill this week. And the other guy is Kevin Brady of Texas. He's chairman of the Powerful Ways and Means Committee, both sort of talking about why they need to get this moving and get it moving fast.
Introduction of this bill is just the first step in helping American families across the country obtain truly affordable health care. And we're eager to get started.
As Republicans, we have a choice. We can act now, or we can keep fiddling around and squander this opportunity repeal Obamacare, and begin a new chapter of freedom for the American people. House Republicans are choosing to act now.
Their audience right now is other Republicans, conservatives across the House and Senate, John, who already, in many ways, are panning this proposal in tweets calling it Obamacare Light or Obamacare 2.0. A lot of them don't like the idea of continuing tax credits or what they think of as subsidies to help people pay for health care. They don't like the idea of extending the Medicaid expansion even for 2 years. Here's Rand Paul of Kentucky. He's leading a group of conservatives who today are out from the House and Senate, both panning this proposal. And this will give you a good idea of what Brady and Walden are talking about.
This is Obamacare light. It will not pass. Right. Conservatives aren't going to take it.
Rand Paul is part of a group of three senators who said that they're not voting for anything that doesn't completely and totally repeal Obamacare before there's any replacement. They think that this is not it. There's a group of another four senators who said they're not voting for anything that doesn't fully preserve the Medicaid expansion. That's a group of four Republicans. And then an eighth senator, Susan Collins of Maine, saying she doesn't want to vote for any replacement bill that cuts off Planned Parenthood, and this House GOP plan does that. So what all of this is displaying to you here are the different factions among Republicans now that Paul Ryan and Tom Price and the president are going to have to start to thread here, not only to get to 216 votes in the House, which will be difficult, but to get something out of the Senate that can then come back and pass House muster, maybe by Easter, Passover, maybe afterward. And it's going to be difficult with all the different factions involved here. One of the factions also are House moderates, people who are trying to defend the Medicaid expansion and who actually like to see some of the tax credit subsidies stay in place. Here's Charlie Dent. He's from Central Pennsylvania. Actually, he represents Hershey, Pennsylvania, my hometown, and he represents a group of House moderates here. I talked to Charlie Dent a little bit about the difficulty of putting together the votes, not only in the House right now, this week or next week, but by the summertime to get something passed and on the president's desk.
So you don't have the votes, you may not have the votes in the House. I've been asking, who are the eight Senate Democrats who are going to help us replace? You know,
nobody knew health care was so complicated.
Well, yeah, who knew?
He's laughing because, of course, they knew how complicated it was. And that's why we're not getting health care cost estimates out of this Ryan plan, as well as the uncertainty about the votes that you're talking about.
And this is really important. You're talking about estimates. That's the CBO, the Congressional Budget Office. Markups of this plan start in House committees tomorrow. There is no CBO score, which means members don't know how much this costs, how exactly it's paid for. You have tax subsidies across this plan. There are no tax increases. Republicans don't believe in those, of course. Do they intend to increase the deficit? Will it reduce the deficit? Where do we pay for this, and how much does it cost? And, John, that critical question. How many people lose coverage after 5 years or 10 years?
Todd Zwillig, Takeaway Washington correspondent, talking about health care and the new plan out of Capitol Hill. Thanks so much, Todd.
You got it, John.
The Department of Stating the obvious.
Iraq is an important ally in the fight to defeat ISIS, with their brave soldiers fighting in close coordination with America's men and women in uniform.
That's Secretary of State Rex Tillerson identifying perhaps the most embarrassing oversight in the original Trump administration travel ban that caused so much chaos last month. The new retooled travel ban, subject to court challenge, announced yesterday, belatedly recognizes Iraq as an ally, but the correction took some convincing, apparently. Iraqi Prime Minister Haider al-Abadi reportedly had to lobby President Trump over the phone about the issue last month and follow up with Vice President Mike Pence in Munich. Omar al-Nadawi is director for Iraq at Griffin Partners, a strategic advisory firm. He came to the U.S. from Iraq in 2007 and says the travel ban, even in its corrected form, makes it difficult for the United States to work with its much-needed friends in the Middle East.
Well, certainly it seemed to many Iraqis as an insult for, given that how much security cooperation, intelligence cooperation between the United States and Iraq over the years, and how intertwined the military planning for counterterrorism operations have been, it just seemed like a very unnecessary insult to Iraqis who are, you know, who see themselves as the primary victims of terrorism. So it was needless. I think a lot of Iraqis are feel vindicated or relieved now that the new ban excludes Iraq, but definitely there is a little bit of a bitter taste that is left by the original ban.
Do you think, Omar, that there were operational difficulties in the sense that this ban came down right in the middle of the operation to retake Mosul from al-Qaeda, and that U.S. and Iraqi forces were directly in combat operations and had to rely on the cooperation of each other? And this ban all of a sudden says that it doesn't matter what you do with the U.S., you can't guarantee that you're going to be able to get your family into the United States.
Well, I think judging by the results on the ground, I don't think there was a significant impact on ongoing counterterrorism operations. Was there an impact on level of trust and the sense of how much we can rely on each other as allies? I think that sense was shaken from the Iraqi point of view.
What do you think going forward the alliance between the U.S. and Iraq will mean? Syria is still part of the ban, and the Syrian operation is taking place, you know, with help from Iraqi forces. What do you think has changed there? Anything?
A lot of the future of U.S.-Iraq cooperation is going to be shaped in the few weeks, or let's say the few months, that will follow the pushing out of ISIS from Mosul. That's when Iraqi politics actually start to kick in, and we will see the post-ISIS power struggle and political struggle inside Iraq come back to the surface. I think the ban will be a marginal sideshow to that, but the primary factors are going to be what objectives are going to be developed by the various leaderships in Iraq. How are the Kurdish leaders going to revise their agenda after Mosul is taken? How are the Sunni Arabs in Iraq going to reconstitute their community and their political leadership, and if they ever manage to do that, and what are they going to seek? And, you know, the same goes for the federal government in Baghdad and what the major Shia political bloc is going to see.
And what about personally? Were you concerned about your ability to travel and your ability to connect with your own family?
Well, I'm one of the lucky ones who managed to have stayed in the United States for a long time to be naturalized. So I don't have a personal fear myself, but I think I was more concerned of what it means for the United States as a welcoming country, as a country built on freedom and welcoming people who are fleeing oppression. The ban seemed absurd, given how strict I think the vetting processes already were prior to the ban. I myself experienced that in 2006, 2007, when I was trying to come to the United States as a student, and it took me several months. So to see an additional layer of discrimination against specific countries, it didn't make sense to select a specific set of six or seven countries. And that seemed political. It didn't seem to be really motivated by national security interests.
Omar, before we go, what would you do to try to design a policy that both addresses security and makes a more coherent statement to the nations of the Middle East?
I would remove the ban and start instead to review and develop a strategy for counter-radicalization, because I think that's the real problem. I looked at, you know, one of the two cases that the New Order cited as, you know, justification for its issuing was, for example, there was the fact that a Somali person who immigrated to the United States as a child was convicted of attempting to detonate a car bomb or a weapon of similar level in Oregon, I think, in 2010. And so it seems like a non sequitur. This person immigrated to the United States as a child, as a refugee. He was radicalized here. Now, how do we deal with that? A travel ban on 6 or 7 or 12 countries is not the problem. We'll also look at some of the other recent and tragic terrorist attacks that happened in the United States, the San Bernardino or the Orlando Club shooting. Both were committed by people who had no relation to these six countries. In the Orlando case, the attacker was born in New York. In the other, one of the two attackers was born in Pakistan and immigrated through Saudi Arabia. So putting a geographic, an arbitrary geographic ring around the problem is not going to solve it.
Omar, thank you so much.
Thank you, John.
Omar al-Nadawi is director for Iraq at Griffin Partners, a strategic advisory firm. Omar came to the U.S. from Iraq in 2007. This is the story of a drug conviction that had an outcome that may transform the way healthcare is delivered in the American prison system. Nicholas Glisson was just 37 days into an 8-year prison sentence for a felony drug charge. He had specific medical needs as a result of laryngeal cancer, but his cancer was fully manageable. In prison, though, he was under the care of Corizon Health, a private company providing medical care to prisoners in Indiana's Department of Corrections. But Nicholas Glisson died on October 10th, 2010, and this is how his mother, Alma Glisson, remembers him.
Nick is my firstborn son in 1960. He was 9 pounds, 4 ounces, a good, healthy baby, and he grew into a great young man, was married, had 2 children. He had 5 siblings, and we all miss him very much. He was always there for us. He was a great guy. That's why I miss him, because he was so great, and he's my son.
What happened to Nicholas and what it means for private prison contractors if a jury rules in his family's favor is the subject of this week's Case in Point from the Marshall Project. Andrew Cohen, commentary editor at the Marshall Project and author of Case in Point, says health care and prison sentencing often come into very serious conflict.
What happened to Nicholas Glisson is, I think people who have a bad experience in a hospital can relate to it. If you've ever been in a bad hospital with a loved one or maybe yourself, where each of the nurses goes in and out, they're on shifts, they don't really talk to one another, the doctors come at different times, they don't necessarily confer with each other, and if they do, they don't confer with you. And what happened was Corizon, this is the allegation of the complaint, the allegation in the case that is now looks like it's going to go to a jury. The argument is that every nurse and doctor did what he or she thought that they could do to help. But in the overall scheme of the medical treatment of this man, it was a complete failure. The right hand didn't know what the left hand was doing. One doctor would be concerned about the mental health of the inmate, and yet another doctor already was treating him for mental health problems. There was a question about feeding, nutrition. One doctor ordered that he be fed manually so that he could get some sustenance. That order was never fulfilled. And what the courts so far have seen is this notion that you can have a conscious choice by a company to have such a managed care program that fails in so many ways that it actually rises to the level of a constitutional violation or a violation that at least could generate a money damage award. And that's why that's where we are at this stage of the case.
How do courts view individuals who, in addition to whatever they've been convicted of, have medical conditions that could exacerbate or threaten their lives while they're in custody, and thus adding a dimension to their sentence that isn't explicitly referred to in the actual sentencing?
Yeah, I mean, that's another element of this case and why I thought it was significant to sort of share. This was clearly a disabled man. He had cancer. He was surviving with cancer. But it was made clear to the prosecutor, it was made clear to the sentencing judge, that this was a man who was going to need an awful lot of intense day-to-day, hour-to-hour medical care in prison. The doctor who was treating Nicholas Glisson at the time of his sentencing said so, told the judge, I don't think this is a good candidate for confinement. He's doing okay on his own. He's able to live independently. He's able to help his grandmother, for example. But if you put him in prison, it's not going to go well. And yet the prosecutor pushed ahead. The sentencing judge pushed ahead with an 8-year sentence, and this is the result of it. And let me back up. The reason why Nicholas Glisson was in this kind of trouble to begin with is that he had been caught selling 2 oxycodone pills, to a person he thought was a friend who evidently turned out to be a confidential informant. So this was not the kind of serious crime that you equate with somebody who is disabled, who is forced to go to prison.
Although it is the case that he wasn't a drug kingpin, but with all of the discussion of the opioid crisis, how are courts to deal with this as a serious crime and acknowledge the fact that there are extenuating circumstances with people like Nicholas?
That's exactly right. And that was the issue that the trial judge, the sentencing judge, faced in 2010. And the decision he made was to send it was a plea deal, but to sentence him to 8 years. The idea was that he would serve four and he would eventually go home. And of course, he didn't last, 2 months inside that facility. Again, in a lot of these cases, and we've covered them before, there is some doctor who is particularly negligent in the treatment or care. There is a situation where an inmate is, left on the floor for 3 or 4 days and not fed and not given water and so forth. We've seen these cases over and over again. This wasn't that. There were doctors and nurses with Corizon who were trying to help Nicholas Glisson. In the end, though, they simply couldn't give him the level of care that you could argue the Constitution requires him to get. And it'll be fascinating to see if this case does go to a jury, what jurors are going to say about the level of care. I think that's why Corizon is so concerned about this case, right? If you get a jury verdict here, and if you get this idea that there can be liability, even when there's not necessarily a single smoking gun, then it raises the possibility of expanded liability in other prison cases. And of course, Corizon has a lot of these cases going.
And so this is a privatized facility in the criminal justice system that claims it could take care of an individual with a medical condition that required constant care and failed miserably.
Yes, this is a public facility contracting out its health care to the private prison healthcare giant Corizon, which went to court, defended itself, said, look, we were not deliberately indifferent. Our doctors and nurses did the best they could. And there is some traction for that. There were a lot of the claims that were made by the family that were thrown out of court. But this one case, this sort of novel, if you will, approach to corporate liability has survived. And again, I think there's a lot at stake, not just for the inmates and their families who may in the future want to bring a case like this or a claim like this, but for the companies who are defending themselves in these sorts of situations. If there is liability here and it sticks, you may see more liability. And I think that's why this is one of those cases where there's a lot more at stake than just what's at stake to the family.
Andrew, thank you so much for illuminating a complicated case with a lot of implications depending upon the outcome here.
It's my pleasure. Thank you.
Andrew Cohen is the commentary editor at the Marshall Project and author of Case in Point, a biweekly column exploring a single case or character that sheds light on the criminal justice system. The Department of Defense is investigating an undisclosed number of Marines who shared nude photos of female service members on social media. Members of Marines United, a private Facebook group with over 30,000 members, left derogatory and harassing comments on a number of the photos. Air National Guard pilot Mary Jennings Hagar, who has seen combat, is a decorated Army aviator, and knows the pain of sexual assault by a fellow in uniform, says the impact of these things is far greater than the number of participants.
It is a very small number of people, percentage-wise, who have such a low opinion of women that they can do these things. But it's this majority who's afraid to speak out. It's not a comfortable thing to do, to stand up for what's right. But the more of us who do it, the fewer people are going to be able to intimidate others into silence.
In fact, a former Marine and founder of the War Horse spoke out and broke this story. Thomas Brennan is now receiving death threats since his article was first published. For more, we turn to Thomas Givens Neff, a staff writer for The Washington Post. He's a former Marine infantryman. Welcome to The Takeaway.
Thanks for having me.
Clarify the First Amendment issues with the coercive qualities of some of these photos were posted without the permission of women, and the question of who's a consenting adult in this situation. Is there any clarity there?
Yeah, I don't think there's any clarity here. I mean, and I don't think the Marine Corps is going to try and parse through it. There's a saying, at least, when I was in, you kind of give up your First Amendment rights when you join the Marine Corps. You know that you're kind of in that system. I mean, whether that's the case or not is moot. But I think what the Marine Corps is going to do is I think they're and I hope would take a look at the culture, right, that allowed this to persist. I was talking to a female soldier whose pictures ended up in one of these groups. It was just like an Instagram picture that was taken, a screenshot that was taken off and posted in a group and followed by harassing remarks. And, you know, she basically said this isn't something that I think we would see in the Army because we treat each other more like brothers and sisters while the Marine Corps sees itself as a brotherhood that doesn't have room for women, which I thought was pretty powerful coming from a 20-year-old woman.
As a former Marine yourself, do you think that that's an unstoppable sort of culture, that you're not really going to be able to bring women into the Marines and have much of an impact on that brotherhood concept?
You know, this in a generation will probably look back and see, you know, this is probably where that started, right? This kind of, you know, transformation. And I think we're at this inflection point where we're at the tail end of two protracted ground wars. You have NCOs, you know, sergeants, staff sergeants who probably fought in Iraq and Afghanistan and are bringing a maybe not nonchalant, but a kind of view where this wasn't an issue for them, right? They didn't have Facebook or the internet. They were fighting wars and, you know, dealing with deployed life. And then you have junior Marines who are and junior service members who are kind of brought up in this much more social media accessible age, and they're kind of clashing. And, you know, when these, if you know, brought up correctly, when they kind of take the mantle as senior leaders or senior enlisted leaders, that hopefully that, you know, the higher leadership has seen this enough and knows how to deal with it, so that culture kind of gets beaten out.
But you can see people not reenlisting as a result of this, men and women.
You know, I live with a Marine who I served with, and you know, we were talking about this last night, and I said, you know, what would you say to a you know, someone who is joining a woman who is joining the Marine Corps? And he's like, you know, I'd say what I always say is like, you know, yeah, maybe I join another branch of the service because you're not going to get treated that well in the Marines, and that's the issue.
Thomas Givens Neff is a staff writer for the Washington Post and a former Marine. Thomas, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. The state of Ohio is one of the leaders in the country for overdose deaths, not necessarily a leadership they're proud of. One in nine of those deaths is related to heroin. And in 2015, the Centers for Disease Control found that heroin overdoses in Ohio had tripled over the course of 5 years. Lucky overdose patients are actually brought back to life in some cases with the drug naloxone. But now in Fayette County in Ohio, that treatment won't come without some consequences in the court system, which could be a pathway to treatment. Barry Bennett is a paramedic and also an executive director of the Pickaway Area Recovery Services, which runs the Fayette Recovery Center and Fayette Women's Residence Program. How has your community decided to do something fundamentally different to treat people who come in contact with the criminal justice system as a result of their addiction?
Well, what's happened is we had 45 drug overdoses in January and 56 overdoses in February, and 12 of those resulted in deaths. So we're trying to think outside the box. And when a squad or paramedics went to a home and it was an overdose, they decided to charge them with inducing panic. And there were some people really against that, to have legal charges about an overdose. But I was really in favor of it, because it's a possibility then with some legal charges that they can be ordered into treatment.
So in this situation, you find people who are overdosing and you could treat them with naloxone. And
yes,
and bring them back and charge them immediately with this misdemeanor. But that misdemeanor is a pathway to treatment.
It is. And a lot of people do not understand that until a person has consequences and pain greater than the pleasure of the drug, they aren't just going to wake up in the morning and yawn and say, I'm going to quit today. It takes some issues to get them into treatment. And with heroin addicts, especially that we have, they are not going to quit until, again, the consequences and pain outdistance the pleasure of the drug.
Have you personally revived someone with naloxone?
Yes, I have.
And when you bring somebody back, I mean, are they ready to go into rehab, or do they just basically say, oh, thank you, now leave me alone?
Well, it's both. For some people who have an overdose, they've had multiple overdoses, And they do not, you know, you would think they'd say, man, I need help. I want to change. They don't. They think somebody else can die, but they can't. You understand what I'm saying?
Right.
And so what happens is with this charge, at least the court's involved. In Fayette County, we have a tremendous relationship with the courts. And the court refers people to us all the time. And our judges in Fayette County, they're interested in not only just putting people in jail, but helping individuals. And I got to tell you, when I deal with parents, they are so hurting over the addiction of their children. And I really believe when you look at 45 overdoses in January and 56 in February, I really think the community said, we have to do all we can do. And I believe part of that is that misdemeanor charge.
Do you have enough treatment facilities there in the community?
I got to tell you, you know, in outpatient, we do not have a waiting list. But in our residentials, we have residentials in three counties here in Ohio, and we're always full. We're always full.
Wow. Barry Bennett, on the front lines, a paramedic and executive director of the Pickaway Area Recovery Services, which runs the Fayette Recovery Center and the Fayette Women's Residential Program. Barry Bennett, thanks so much.
Hey, thanks for having me. I really appreciate it.
The humble voice of perhaps the most powerful woman of the 21st century.
We think that we have the possibility to make this great transition from conflict to democracy and development. I've been involved in politics for quite some time. I've held positions and my experience are very deep, and I think I have the capacity, the character, and the courage to institute the kinds of reform that are so desperately needed.
That's Ellen Johnson Sirleaf speaking as a presidential candidate in Liberia's Unity Party just months before she won 59% of the second round runoff vote, making her the first female elected head of state in Africa's history. Sirleaf's story is a personal triumph over violence, but it's also a political triumph over a male-dominated country where sexual violence had become the norm, civil war had ravaged the future of every Liberian. President Sirleaf won a second term of office in 2011 and is getting ready to step down. Helene Cooper is Pentagon correspondent for The New York Times and author of Madam President, The Extraordinary Journey of Ellen Johnson Sirleaf. Cooper's story is a very personal one, and she tells it with a passion that speaks of her own dual Liberian and American roots, as well as it speaks of her admiration for her subject, President Sirleaf.
I was born in Liberia. I'm a dual citizen, Liberia and the United States. I grew up there, and when I was 14, there was a military coup, and my family ran away, and we came here as immigrants. We came here as refugees, and I eventually became an American citizen. But Liberia is connected to the United States.
It's a refugee nation.
It was founded by freed American slaves who, in 1822, and my great-great-great-great-grandfather, Elijah Johnson, was on the first ship that sailed from New York to the west coast of Africa. They founded this country. The problem was they set up the same kind of antebellum society there that they had fled from in the American South, except now they were the privileged elites, and the rest of the Africans in Liberia became sort of the rest of the population, and they were the servants. And this two-tiered system existed for 150 years until in 1980, finally, there was a military coup with enlisted soldiers overthrowing the old guard. It plunged the country into an enormous amount of turmoil that eventually led to the Civil War that began in 1989 with the now infamous Charles Taylor.
Right.
Liberia went through hell for the next 15 years, and you had child soldiers, you had women who were, 70% of the women in Liberia have gone through rape or some sort of sexual assault. Electricity was gone because the hydro plant was bombed out. There was no running water. The country was horrific.
Did the people that you grew up with experience that directly?
Yes. Yes, absolutely. During the military coup, my uncle, who at the time was Minister of Foreign Affairs, was executed on the beach by firing squad. My mom was gang raped, trying to save. In an effort, she traded herself for soldiers were after me and my younger sisters. at the time when we were children. And this is one of the things that so many women in Liberia go through. Every woman in Liberia that you meet practically is a survivor of some sort, which is one of the reasons why I wanted to do this book on the women's movement and on Ellen Johnson Sirleaf, because the sort of the punctuation at the end of this grim story is that after 2 decades of civil war, the women who had literally been carrying this country on their backs, the market women who were still, even during the war after being raped, would have their children of the rapists and their rapists in the forest, strap those children on their backs and go back to the sides of the road and make market and sell oranges, and they drove the economy. And they kind of realized that they were running the country anyway, and they made this power move to take political power and vote in Ellen Johnson Sirleaf in 2005, the first woman ever elected president of an African country.
What did that say to you as a Liberian, as well as what did it say to all of the people of Africa who in various nations have problems dealing with patriarchy and all those kinds of things?
As a Liberian and an American, I sort of watched the war from here, very safe. And I was horrified at the images coming over TV, the things we were seeing. And then all of a sudden, to go from that to watching my own native Liberian sisters do something like this, for the first time in my life, I felt proud to be Liberian. I felt like, I can't believe Liberia is serving as an example for somewhere, because Africa is very patriarchal. But at the end of the day, they seized power for themselves. And I think the biggest lesson I probably learned from this was that for these women, particularly women in Liberia, they decided they weren't going to wait for the men to give them power. They weren't going to wait to be handed anything. They were going to just take it themselves, and they did.
How did she escape from the violence of the Civil War, and how much did she escape from it?
She has a really rich history. She was thrown in. She served in the Talbert government, and was actually the Minister of Finance at the time of the 1980 coup, and all of her other colleagues were executed on the beach by firing squad. She was not, because she was a woman, in large part. Because at the time, Liberian women, you know, there's this view that in Liberia, Liberian women were bent for raping, not for killing. There's so much weird, you know, so much extraordinary undercurrents going on there. And then she went to work for the government that had overthrown the government that she worked for, thinking that she was better off. Her rationale, she says, is that she needed to see if she could help them. But that only lasted a few months, and then she resigned, angry because of a lot of the corruption that was going on, and moved to the U.S. She ended up working for the World Bank, the IMF, the United Nations. She polished off her global bureaucratic pedigree, and then went back to Liberia to try to run for Senate, and ended up getting thrown into jail for her trouble. In a lot of ways, as I write in the book, she was thrown into a cell in 1985, right after there was an attempted coup that she had not had any part of. But she was thrown into this cell where all the men in the cell next to her were executed as she was listening. They were shot by firing squad. And then a man comes in, one of the soldiers who was holding her comes in and threatens to rape her, and somebody saves her again and steps in. And then right after that, this young Gio girl, who's 18 or 19, who'd been gang raped by all of these soldiers outside, and they brought her bleeding and hysterical into the cell with Ellen Johnson Sirleaf, and she was comforting her. And it's sort of in that moment, as the two of them are in this cell together and both thinking they're going to be, one has already been raped and Ellen thinking that she is about to be, it sort of ignited the flame of this women's movement, because that is one of the seminal moments in Ellen Johnson Sirleaf's life, when she realized that she's going to try to do everything she can to put herself and make sure that nothing like this can happen again. It took years, because after that, then Charles Taylor took over, and there was... The history is so interesting, and it's so complex. But she was like, when she was in the cell with that Gio girl, she was like 45 years old, and it's when she's 67 that she finally becomes president.
Helene, thank you so much.
Thanks a lot
and
for having me, John.
Congratulations on this book.
Thank you.
Terrific stuff. Helene Cooper is Pentagon correspondent for the New York Times and author of Madam President, The Extraordinary Journey of Ellen Johnson Sirleaf, President of Liberia. What a way to end Leadership Here and Afar, America's Curious Connection to Liberia, a land created for refugees, let's not forget. Creating hope for its own future where for so long there had been none. A remarkable story, that, for our time. That's our show for today. You can give us your take at 877-8-MY-TAKE or send us a tweet at The Takeaway. Thanks for listening. As always, I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, the New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for the New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.